I'm Margaret Hawthorne, and I realize as I look around that some but not all of you know what's happened in my family in the last few years, so I hadn't planned to, but I will just give a brief summary or a brief story. In 2010, April of 2010,
move you forward a little bit into the circle.
Okay. Is my voice not strong enough? Sure. Our three daughters were at the time 31, 29, and 26 or 27. And our oldest daughter, Molly, had been married about 5 years, very happily. She was living in Henniker, New Hampshire, was about 3 weeks from graduating from nursing school here at NHTI. She and her husband were living on the family farm in Henniker. And our middle daughter, Ruby, was out exploring the world. She had been living in China for about 8 months and had just the day before flown to visit a friend, found a cheap flight to Moscow to visit a friend there who was also out studying and exploring. And our youngest daughter, Sadie, was at home on she and her husband had a farm in Acworth, New Hampshire, and two young boys. I received a phone call. I called Sheila. I needed to get to Henniker immediately, and it sounded bad, and I asked Sheila to drive me. And the short story is that Molly had been murdered in her home on the farm. Molly had worked at the Concord Feminist Health Center, and I immediately assumed that it was an assassination, and I urged the police to protect all of the people who worked at the health center. So it was a surprise to me when there was a very quick arrest within 3 days, and it had nothing to do with the health center. A young man had moved on to the family farm less than a week before, and he fixated on Molly, and when she declined his advances, he killed her. Within the first day or so, I made a statement that went out into the press very quickly, that our family would not yield to hatred. And I thought I was addressing an assassination. The young man was Haitian, and the online chatter was stunning, appalling, much of it. I would say there was also some very loving supportive, but the two statements that I remember, one was, if they can't be more responsible, I hope there are no other children living in their home because they don't deserve to be parents, meaning Bruce, my husband, and me. And the other was, if they can't hate, or if they won't hate, we'll hate for them. And this was coming so strongly out of white supremacy, because the young man was Haitian. And so the work of my last years obviously has been learning to live in a world without Molly and in a world where this happened. Nearly 2 years passed between the arrest of Rudy Florigoust, 3 days after he murdered Molly, and the time when a New Hampshire judge accepted a plea bargain that sentenced him to 40 years to life. In those 2 years, I had become active in working to abolish the death penalty in New Hampshire, testifying in the State House a couple times. And I don't need to rehearse all the reasons for opposing the death penalty. I think, Oh, it's the heat. I thought it was a pipe bursting. Anyway, I think I'd be preaching to the choir to go through that. But I testified that although Molly's murder did not fit the criteria for capital charges, when it happened in 2010, under proposed expansions of the death penalty, the same crime a year later could potentially have been prosecuted as a capital case. I was relieved not to have capital punishment in the equation. I wouldn't have wanted anyone put to death in Molly's name. And I felt no differently about the death penalty after she was murdered than I had before. Between 2010 and 2012, I tried to concentrate on learning to live in a world without Molly, and I tried not to focus on the outcome of the judicial process. I found two postponements of the trial, one for 6 months and another for another couple of weeks after that. I found that annoying, but the district attorney indicated that the state had a tight case, and they had a confession, they had strong incriminating evidence, and that made it easier for me to let the state do its work, knowing that the death penalty wasn't in the equation. And even when things seemed to drag, I was pretty much able to set the judicial process aside. Then, although I opposed the death penalty, I trusted that Mr. Fleurgust would be tried for first-degree murder. A conviction would mean mandatory life in prison. I was certain that he was too broken when he killed Molly to ever safely reintegrate into society. At the same time, I believed that 40 years in the prison system would further harden him. So in this bewildering paradox, I wanted him contained, but I knew that very containment could lessen the likelihood of rehabilitation. The prosecution's sudden announcement of a possible plea bargain stunned me. They started negotiating for 50 years, dropped it to 45, and eventually settled on 42 with 2 years' time served. To encourage Mr. Fleurgust to accept the deal, they explained, they wanted to give him hope that he might one day return to his homeland of Haiti. And I said, hope? My daughter is dead. What hope is there in that? I said, I don't want this plea bargain in the first place, and you're asking me to give him hope. Now I want to tell you about Wilbert Rideau, and some of you may have read his book, In the Place of Justice. Rideau grew up poor and black in Louisiana. His father abandoned the family when he was 13. Throughout his teen years, he worked to help his mother put food on the table, and in 1961, at age 19, he botched a bank robbery and killed a white employee. Upon his arrest, he confessed to the murder under duress. An all-white jury convicted him of first-degree murder, sentencing him to die in Louisiana's electric chair. The U.S. Supreme Court later called that trial a kangaroo court, but two retrials in the state of Louisiana in 1964 and 1970 upheld the convictions. Rideau never retracted his confession, but he claimed the killing was a panic reaction rather than a premeditated act. And a first-degree conviction based on premeditation was necessary to secure the death sentence. A 1972 U.S. Supreme Court ruling abolished capital punishment for the time being, as we know. With the death penalty out of the equation, Louisiana began to apply a curious 10-6 policy. An inmate convicted of murder who had served 10 years and 6 months or more on a life sentence and demonstrated rehabilitation could be paroled. So in this fickle turn, the state began releasing men it had previously intended to kill. Rideau no longer faced execution. By that time, he had been on Louisiana's death row for nearly 12 years. Over the next 3 decades, he would watch the state free other former death row inmates while consistently keeping him behind bars. The case was a political hot potato. No one wanted to be known for freeing a black man who had killed a white woman. In a fourth trial in 2005, the conviction was changed from first-degree murder to manslaughter, carrying a lesser sentence. Rideau was released immediately, having served 45 years in prison. Much of his story is about an amazing rehabilitation that that happened within him without support of the prison system in the time that he was there. Throughout his all those years of incarceration in one of the nation's most violent institutions, Rideau maintained a strong drive for personal integrity. He did not deny or try to minimize the impact of his crime, but focused instead on becoming the best human being he could be. A 1993 Life article in Life magazine referred to him as the most rehabilitated prisoner in America. He became the first black editor of Angola Prison's prison newsletter, which went on to win national literary awards. For a while, he was the inside reporter for Terry Gross's Fresh Air. He had a lot of contact through his writing, which a skill that he tapped into and developed on his own in prison. Reading Rideau's story made me step back. I found myself rooting for him, glad for his eventual release, although I had opposed anything less than a life sentence for Mr. Fleurgoust. I realized how much I wanted to control Fleurgoust's redemption. I wanted to see it happen, but in a confined setting. I wanted him to become a good inmate, a role model who would use his own life to mentor others constructively. I wanted him to become Wilbert Rideau, but stay in prison. Today, in New Hampshire and Louisiana and a number of other states, mandatory life with no parole is required for a first-degree murder conviction. The only possible release, the only possibility for release then is an appeal or pardon. Groups working to abolish the death penalty often hold up life with no parole as an alternative. I considered that valid until I read Rideau's story. Now I'm less sure. I love a miracle as much as the next person. Rideau's miracle is that he transformed himself in the very place where it seems against all odds. So if I believe one man could do it, is it for me to say another cannot? And I'll say I really struggled with, found myself, because my husband and I ran a home for 35 years for mentally disabled veterans, and in that time we had accidentally placed with us two men who earned the diagnosis of sociopath in the time that they were with us, and it was very frightening and became dangerous. I was wanting a diagnosis for Mr. Fleurgoust. And I guess I still do, but lacking one from the state, I sort of applied sociopath because I didn't know anything about him. His crime was so shocking and so off the charts, it was all I could think of. But I just have had to rethink everything looking at the rehabilitation. Just one man's rehabilitation story has made me rethink, at least to recognize I don't know that Mr. Fleurgoust is a sociopath. I can't know that. The day before Christmas, I sent Mr. Fleurgoust a card. The victim's advocate from the state gave me his address with a caution that he did not have to accept mail from me. For a return address, I used an office in Concord. I wrote, "In this season of wishing one another well and wishing for peace on earth, I continue to pray that you may find peace in your heart." He sent a reply immediately. And this is his reply, part of it. "I like to thank you for taking your time to write to me. I really appreciate it, and it means a lot to me. I know none of what I'm saying now will never change what I've done, and nothing I could give for such a tragedy caused by my own hand. And this is a shame I will live with for the rest of my life. I thank you for praying that I have peace in my heart, because this tragedy left me a heartache no one can heal but God. I pray God to bless you and the others. I pray him to keep y'all strong. I pray that she may forgive me. I pray that the star that led the wise men to where the infant lay shine in your heart and bring you a blessed new year. May the gift of Christ be your greatest treasure. May his love enrich your life throughout the new year. Thank you for your time. Respectfully, Rudy Floragust. When I listened to his apology at the end of the sentencing, I wished for an unrealistic sophistication from him. I longed to hear him acknowledge that while he can't change what he has done, how he chooses to act for the rest of his life is the change he can make. But he was only able to bemoan his inability to change what he had done. Couldn't make that other piece. In this letter, his simplicity and humility move me. I am most touched by the words, "I thank you for praying that I may have peace in my heart, because this tragedy left me a heartache no one can heal but God." For me, Floragust has existed largely in a void. I don't know him, but am in permanent relationship with him because of Molly's death. His presence in my life will not end in my lifetime. Unlike many crime victims' family members, I haven't welcomed the legal process that cuts him off from me. I have to be clear, I do appreciate protection. I'm not saying I want him in my everyday life. But I have a need to know him, to work through in my own heart and mind his humanness. From the outset, I have known that hatred would destroy me, and the best way I can avoid it is by experiencing humanity in the one I would choose to hate. I see Mr. Floragust seated in front of me at the hearing. I can't see his face except when I read my statement. I can study the back of his head, his stooped shoulders, as he hears statement after statement of loss and sadness. He is the person who brought about such heartbreak. He alone wears an orange jumpsuit and shackles. He has put on weight, but what strikes me is the movement of his breath. His back expands and contracts as he draws air in and out like everyone else in the room. Inhale, exhale, inhale, expire, inspire, expire. He's a living being, vulnerable, depending on the breath for life. It turns out I wasn't going to be able to pray for Floragust without experiencing a change in my own heart. For some time, I thought it would be enough to remain neutral and not wish harm on him. However, in the act of sending him a note, a shift happened in me, and I don't know where it will lead. I will leave a little space and then write back to him. I'm exploring a victim-offender dialogue program that New Hampshire offers. The act of loving can be overwhelming. Can I love the... And I liked Jamie's definition or talking about love because, you know, I think about love your enemies and what does that mean. And for me, it is wishing for the best outcome for another person, wishing for the best possible well-being. I think that's my best working understanding of this kind of love. The act of loving can be overwhelming. Can I love the oppressed, truly care about them, and go on living a life in which my needs are abundantly met? Can I love one who emerged from that oppressed world to take my daughter's life?